Here, what I had understood to be the case, that you said in the first, well, the second probably paragraph there, the methods to assess the risk of diffuse discharges are proxies only. They do not accurately reflect the actual risk. And then further down in that paragraph, they are intended to be short-term proxies to be used as rural gateways only. Now, that's a summary of your view of how these matters and being out of our stock market. Is that right?
Yes, it's
And so when you've reinserted the words into policy 2 in a couple of different places, you're not intending that to give those NLLRs more meaning than that. Is that right?
No. I think I'm agreeing with you.
Yes.
Schedule B is linked to the risk categorisation. So in policy 2B, for example, it's moderate risk, asset and that schedule. And that's different than actual risk, which is a different assessment in that same policy.
Understood. And so then the actual rural gateways themselves are contained in the rules in conjunction with what's in Schedule B, rather than being in the policy?
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, they're both in my region, the gateway and the rule is moderate risk, and then moderate risk is defined in CGB.
Right, so that's just a drafting preference of how it's done rather than changing the meaning.
Correct.
Nice, thank you. Now, in the back to the version handed up this morning, we'll continue to move down through there. There's some further wording there where it refers to, you've added off diffuse discharges to water, and I think those are already in Mr. Trebilco's version, but they're added here, I think, because you're adding them to your previous version, is that right?
But I don't think I intended to add any change in
the
because I was focused on the appropriate specified
period. Yes, understood, thank you. And moving over the page to paragraph C, there's some additional wording here about demonstrating the risk of diffuse discharges is already the slowest track for the appropriate specified period. And whether you need to go there or not, you understand that there are some words to those that fit.
That's what I was trying to do,
was
just pick up the changes
here. Understood, thank you. And so then to the main part in relation to how to determine an appropriate specified period. And that's down the page under Now, the version that you've got in front of you there, the words have moved, it appears, because in the council's version, the words subject to the requirement in objective 2 to achieving those interim target attribute states are actually one of the bullet points, I understand. But the council's, one difference between the council's version and yours is that the council's version is expressly subject to the requirement in objective 2, whereas yours refers to reducing reducing the risk within years. So that's the core difference between the two, and so it's the difference of the number of years essentially that you're talking about, as opposed to whether there's a particular point at which it's been whether there's a particular reduction that's being required.
That is the main difference. The other difference, I think, between my version and Mr. Trilby's version is that his wording about an intention to achieve target attribute states rather than a requirement, and I've put my requirements in policy 1 rather than policy 2. And I think that's an important distinction, because the policies should be there to achieve the objectives, not to intend to achieve the objective. It seems a bit vague to me. So my wording in policy 1 is links that more positively, links the policy more positively to the objective rather than a vague reference to intention.
Right, so that's about legal objectiveness.
Correct.
But you would agree that the time frame for implementing particular measures on a particular plan should be determined on a case-by-case basis?
Within parameters that I have proposed around determining appropriate specified periods, so there is some, I think that there needs to be some boundaries around that case-by-case assessment, and that's important so that all farms are working towards achieving the 10-year target state. Within those boundaries, it is a site-specific assessment. Yes.
And that's partly because some farms may have already implemented many of the measures, they may not need 8 years.
Correct. Some measures will be able to be implemented immediately or may have already been implemented. A practical time frame might be less than 8 years. The 8 years is an outer boundary, which is like a process in the year.
Good afternoon. I'm Mr. Cooper, Junior Legal Counsel for the Director General of Conservation. I have a couple of questions for you. In opening submissions, your legal counsel, Ms. Ongley, said a paragraph 49G that in general water bodies be identified and treated as critical source areas. Yes. That's your, I guess, your planning view that they should be?
That's the effect of the provisions that I've
put. So I'd just like to talk to you a little bit, you've heard the court's discussion on the definition of critical source areas.
Yes.
So I've been exploring that definition and a bit of a work in progress.
Mm.
I've got a bit of a draft here and there's some questions I'd like to ask you.
Sure.
If that's okay.
Yes.
I'll just... Thank you. this is a work in progress, and I'm still handwriting changes. but I just have a question for you regarding. I'll get you ready. This question relates to paragraph B there in the draft definition. And I'm just thinking through the word disproportionately large. And had a bit of a go there of saying compared to other areas within the relevant single operating unit that do not accumulate water containing contaminants. Do you have any thoughts on how we could, in a sense, define what disproportionately large means?
I don't have a solution. It has been exercised in my mind. I think that the phrase disproportionately large is quite problematic. Because if there was a property that had a lot of critical sources, if it had a lot of, for example, troughs or pug areas around them that were in the middle of stables, it would be easy to just pick out the worst one and concentrate on that as a critical source area. And it's my understanding of the farm system expert evidence that actually each one of those is a critical source area. It's my understanding that it's the combination of the landscape features, so the swale or gully, plus the activity within that that is leading to a concentration of contaminants, so a gateway, a stock feeding area or a trough or a stock camp in that place, which makes it a critical source area, rather than it being the worst stock camp on the property that makes it a critical source area. Yeah, so that's why I consider that the phrase is disproportionately large in this context.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have no further questions. Thank you. I hope it helps. That one.
Thank you. I'm going to start by asking you some questions about PC1 generally, and then we'll ask you some questions in relation to some aspects of my friend's submissions for Fish and Game as well as Fish and Game's position. So firstly, in terms of Plan Change 1, you agree that all four contaminants are important? And equally that the role that all land uses play in relation to all four contaminants is important.
Yes, and point sources.
And everyone needs to do their part.
Yes.
And in terms of how everyone can do their part, do you agree that Plan Change 1 as the first step in terms of getting towards the achievement of Te Tiriti Whai Mana is not really about driving land use change?
I would agree that the policies and methods in Plan Change 1 do not drive land use change.
And so it's more about improvement in on-farm practice or in farm management practices across the various land use types?
That is largely the focus of the provisions. I will qualify my previous answer with high-risk dairy farming, reducing to, the policy requirement is to reduce to moderate risk, in some versions of the provisions, and that may require a system change to move from a high-intensity dairy system to a lower-intensity dairy system. So but in terms of driving changes away from pastoral farming into, say, woody vegetation, no, there's nothing in the change from the dry land change.
Thank you. And so then, as far as the key components of Plan Change 1, would you agree that the incorporation of FEPs is a critical component of Plan Change 1?
Absolutely. Really, Plan Change 1 relies for farming, relies on Schedule C and farm environment lands, and that change from high risk to low risk. Those are extreme key mechanisms for driving change.
And also the minimum standards as well?
Yes, obviously, yes.
And so then, in terms of different farming activities, and if we look at dairying, for example, whether a farm is a controlled activity, say, or restricted discretionary activity, you'd expect that it's the same types of conditions that would be imposed?
The difference between the types of conditions that the council could impose on a restricted discretionary versus a controlled activity, and whether the constraints around conditions not interfering with the purpose of the consent, the extent to which that would be at play on an individual farm, and the difference that might make to how the council would issue
I put it to you that there isn't a difference, though, as far as the concern about undermining the purpose of a consent, that whether it's control or restricted discretion, that wouldn't make a difference.
Yes, I'm not sure on that. So that's a legal issue, which I don't want to stray into, but my understanding is that it's very context specific and would come down to an assessment of facts on a particular farm. And we obviously can't anticipate all of those in this hearing. That's what gives me pause as to whether there could be an argument that a particular high risk farm, for example, if there was an argument that a council couldn't impose a condition requiring less feed to be bought on or the stock numbers to drop and really reduce that risk, would that undermine that part of Plan Change 1 and make it effective? And so that's why I cannot wholeheartedly agree with that.
Okay. But irrespective of whether it's a controlled or restricted discretionary activity, it's also still the same FEP requirements.
Yes.
And then as far as council monitoring, as far as the implementation of any requirements, that would be the same as to whether it was a controlled or restricted discretionary activity as well.
As to how the council monitors and enforces consent conditions. I'm not sure if the council had just had different policies. I don't know what their long-term enforcement policies are. So.
Okay. Do you happen to have a copy of the legal submissions for your client that were presented earlier today handy? And so I just want to take you to some questions in relation to my friend's submission to Fish and Game in relation to the drafting gate. And so this is paragraph, starts at 84, and it's 85 that I wish to take you to. Now, does your position in relation to the drafting gate, is this section of the submissions reflective of your position as well?
Well, the region of the provisions of my evidence does use an option of scorecard as a drafting gate option. And I have set out at the beginning of Schedule B that those drafting gate options do have limitations in their use. At the time I wrote my evidence, I felt that was a useful a tool to act as a sorting hat or when activities more things for assessment. So long as the limitations of that tool is clearly set forth in the plan.
And so then is it your view that whether it is the overseer and the use of NLLR or it's the nitrogen risk scorecard that's used as a drafting gate or some combination, that doesn't change your view as to whether Plan Change 1's objectives can be achieved?
So long as the tool used for sorting identifies the highest risk activities and those are dealt with appropriately for a risk assessment process, I don't think it matters terribly, and I think I did agree with the statement to the effect of the joint statement that alternative tools might be appropriate so long as they are broadly consistent with each other. The methods of calculating
sorting
into relative risk.
Certainly.
And that's what Plan Change 1 does.
And so, in that regard, I take it from what you said in the joint witness statement, from your evidence, and then from your question, your answers to questions now, that you agree that the nitrogen risk scorecard does achieve that?
I think with the provisos that I've set out in my evidence, it does. As long as it's perfectly clear to people that what the nitrogen risk scorecard does is sort rather than actually identify risk, so I think that's a very important difference, then I'm comfortable from a planning perspective. Obviously, I can't comment on the technical merits of the tool. But that has to be very clear because it needs to be distinct from the actual assessment of minimising risk. So a reducing nitrogen risk scorecard score doesn't actually necessarily equate to a reduction in risk on a farm, so you can't use it by itself for doing a resource consensus assessment. And plan to be very clear on that point.
The provisions, though, don't seek to say that the scorecard is the be-all and end-all, so just do that?
Well, not in my version anyway. Other versions do take a different approach to how the scorecard is used. Using it as a threshold, not rising or getting down to. But in the version, my version of the provisions, it's not used in that way.
So, in terms of the post-conference and council version, do you have a concern in that respect, in terms of the way that the risk scorecard is used?
I've had to sit down carefully and go through them, because I do not have the top of my mind.
Okay. And I understand that you've been listening into a fair degree of the hearing to date. Were you listening in when Dr. Oladobi was questioned?
Unfortunately, I wasn't able to attend the hearing when the council was giving the evidence.
Okay. Have you looked at the transcript of the council's presentation?
Not that one.
Now, in terms of limitations as to the drafting gate, which is a point you've raised previously, you would accept that Overseer only purports to look at nitrogen leaching, but doesn't look at other conditions. contaminants?
That's my understanding, but it also does have a course assessment of phosphorus, loss risk.
But that's not being used in PC1, is it?
No.
Now, in terms of your concern about ensuring that the highest risk farms have the greatest scrutiny, is that a fair reflection of your position?
Well, that's the scheme of Plan Change 1.
Yes.
Which is set out in the policy and followed up in the rules, is that farms are categorised according to their risk and there are greater levels of scrutiny according to that.
But in terms of your potential, your reservation in terms of the use of scorecard, it was ensuring that the highest risk farms are identified and have that scrutiny. I think that was an answer you gave to me earlier.
What I was meaning with that was that if you're going to have more than one tool in Schedule B for categorising, then they should be broadly equivalent to each other at identifying the highest risk and the moderate risk, etc., so that there's minimised gaming between using different tools and different categories.
Sure, so that's in a situation where there are two drafting gates used within Schedule B.
Yes. Or three or one.
Sure. And in terms of the use of the risk scorecard, and in answer to a question earlier, you also indicated that a reduction in the risk that scorecard generates doesn't equate to a corresponding reduction in risk to the river. Is that your position?
That's my understanding of how the tool works, because the tool only gives scores for management actions. It doesn't give scores for underlying biophysical factors such as soil climate and slope. So changing a management factor might not necessarily move farm into a different biophysical environment. It's only can just seem to risk.
Sure.
So it's important that it's treated in that way.
But if a farmer were forced to reduce their nitrogen risk scorecard output number, any reductions would still be of benefit to the river, wouldn't they?
If the management actions leads to a reduction, an actual reduction in discharge, then that would be of benefit to the river, yes.
And equally, in a situation where just oversea we use, there could be farms in reasonably benign geophysical conditions. Then in those situations, that oversea number would suggest that there aren't any management changes required, potentially, if you look at it compared to the rest of the relevant FMU, for example.
I don't think that's the way that's not the way Plan Change 1 uses oversea. It uses it as a drafting gate, and assessments of how the farm is contributing to the contaminant load in the river are done for a combination of tools, including farm environment plan. Overseer only models nitrogen loss, lichen loss, and Plan Change 1 is requiring minimisation of risk across all four contaminants. So obviously it's not used in the way that you posed in the question.
Okay. In those submissions, paragraph 85 outlines various concerns that your client has with the use of the scorecard. So in terms of 85A, about the question about the different cohorts, if it were just the scorecard being used, then you wouldn't have that concern. That your concern just relates to gaming, is that right?
Yes. Yes. NRS will be used in the same, well, if the top 25% of NRS scores identify the highest risk farmers, then it's doing a broadly equivalent job that NLR is doing. The hesitation here is that NRS is only management factors and not biophysical, so there may be some farms that are in very high risk landscapes that the NRS doesn't pick up. And so high risk would be poor drainage, high rainfall areas that would have higher nitrogen leaching than the same farm system as my in a well-drained, low rainfall area. So there may be some different farms may end up in different categories using the NRS.
But equally, if you're looking at the highest risk farms from an all four contaminants perspective, Oversteer doesn't necessarily reflect that either, does it?
None of the tools do that.
I think we've covered off B already. C, which looks at this question of whether the tool is simple, transparent, and understandable by farmers. Would you agree that having a planning framework and use of planning tools that are simple, transparent, and understandable by farmers is a relevant consideration in developing a planning framework?
I think we need to put too much emphasis on that criteria because what we are trying to address are very complex problems with very complex solutions, and so I think we need to avoid the temptation to oversimplify things and focus just on the most or the highest, because these are complex and interrelated problems. So if we have a tool, an option between two different tools, and one of them is easier to use than the other, but they both achieve the same thing, the easier to use tool should be preferred. But we shouldn't just use a tool because it's easy to use. We need to use the best tool for the job.
Sure, but in terms of your use of the risk scorecard and your provisions, it isn't because it's simple, transparent, and understandable, is it? Well, just to be clear, would you accept that the tool is simple, transparent, and understandable by farmers?
Initially, I did think that, but I did hear the evidence of the farmers last time the court was here in Hamilton. I heard that they didn't necessarily think it was. And so I'm not as clear as perhaps I was when I wrote my evidence that it is actually well understood by farmers. Even though it is simpler than I was there.
If we move down to E, again, there's this question of creating confusion and potential unfairness. On my reading, this seems to again be a situation if there's dual drafting gates rather than just use of the scorecard. Is that your understanding? Maybe we start with that. Is that your understanding of your client's position?
In terms of what he said, I read as being two parts. There's a preference, some people have a preference, but then there's the other issue that I think that paragraph was pointing to, that the same farm might end up in a different category depending on which tool they use.
Yes. But from your perspective, if there were just one tool being used, does that matter if there are some overs and unders at the fringes, provided that you've got the same proportions in each category?
Yes, think that that's the way Plan 21 is set up. It's just a kind of, it's not really based on the outcome in the water body, it's just based on percentiles. But there are differences between how the NLR might categorise those versus the NRS, and that's based on the biophysical components which we've discussed. So yeah, from those online margins there may be differences, and to be perfectly honest, I'm not sure that I've seen, or I'm not aware of like a direct comparison between who ends up in which categories, with a large sample size. I accept there's some small sample sizes and some anecdotes that have been provided. But yeah, there is a marginal difference, so I accept that.
Given your answers earlier to me as far as the broadly similar conditions that would be imposed, the importance of the FEPs that would have the same requirements and the minimum farming standards that would be the same, those differences at the margins shouldn't affect the course consideration as to whether we're going to achieve Plan Change 1's objectives, though, should it?
Because one of the tools that Plan Change 1 uses is to take high-risk activities and direct them to become moderate risk, so long as you have, as the tool that you choose, does actually identify the high-risk activities, then yes, the outcome will be the same, because it's about moving, chopping off the tail of the normal distribution curve, basically.
Modelling, though, that the court has before it as to whether the Plan Change 1 objectives can or might be achieved, that doesn't rely on particular activity statuses, though, does it?
I honestly don't know.
Okay.
So my understanding is that modelling took into, made some assumptions about improvements in practice and fencing, but I don't think it was as nuanced as you would get certain changes with certain activity statuses. So that's more of a planning question and a modelling question as to how effective a tool might be at actually driving those instrument changes.
Okay. And then moving on to paragraph F, which outlines some concerns as to what the NRS has or hasn't done. Given your understanding of the risk scorecard as a scorecard rather than a model, and that it quite unashamedly doesn't seek to spit out a particular leaching rate, those matters in Romans 1, 2, and 3 aren't relevant to the risk scorecard, are they?
And relevant to how much confidence we can have that we've got the threshold between high and moderate right, between moderate and low right. That's what they're relevant. Do we have confidence that they're actually identifying the highest risk activities? That's what they're relevant to. Or that's my understanding of what they're saying.
That going to your point about whatever tool is used needs to be clear as to its limitations. The scorecard doesn't purport to provide a number that demonstrates what the loss of contaminants to water is, does it?
No, it doesn't. It purports to identify the risk, though, and it doesn't, really.
But you still consider that it is appropriate from a drafting gap perspective. Yes. And in terms of Roman 4 there about it's only suitable for dairy, in terms of the use of Overseer within PC1, that is essentially limited to consideration of nitrogen and consideration of dairy, isn't it?
Well, it's my understanding that the decisions version, any language could use the NLR calculation using Overseer. Now, I understand there's some limitations for some kinds of land, for certain kinds of types of land uses, but, and that the most common scenario would be dairy farming, but it would allow mixed systems, for example, to other land uses that would be hit by the definition of dry stock.
Certainly, certainly. Then in terms of paragraph G, this relates to the potential for a future plan change process involving allocation. And the question of what level of information might be available. Now, firstly, in terms of the scorecard, would you accept that there are a range of inputs that go into that? And that information also needs to have documents or data recorded to be able to demonstrate or validate those inputs into it?
I am not familiar with the validation requirements on the NRS, but I would assume it would be good practice for the plan to require those records to be used.
Yes. And I don't need to take you to it, but as far as Schedule B, Part A 5, that starts the following records in terms of the Council's version, following records substantiating the assessment of the inputs and practices described in one above must be retained for the life of the regional plan. So do you accept that the Council's wording does require that?
Yes.
And then in addition, Schedule A also requires registration of farms with details to be provided. And so, I put it to you that there is a significant amount of information that using the scorecard would still provide for councils, or for the council. Would you accept that?
Yes.
And even in terms of the alternative, as far as use of overseer, that is still the data that requires is in the context of nitrogen and possibly an adjunct in terms of phosphorus, but in terms of a allocative model into the future that presumably should be looking at all four contaminants, there may well be gaps as far as what that might provide as well.
In terms of what the data that the council's division requires to keep, that's input data, so that's input into the farm, which is going to be useful for compliance purposes and gathering information for future plan change. I think the difference is that the NRI can also provide council with output data, at least for nitrogen, which may be very useful for future allocated regime, whereas the nitrogen scorecard wouldn't automatically provide that data. The council would need to gather output data another way if they wanted to.
But only if the output data from overseer were accurate.
Well, the council's required to keep records of outputs for catchment accounting purposes, required to do that by the NPCB. And it's required to use the best information available to do that job. And I think in terms of nitrogen, obviously it probably is the best information we've got available. It has limitations in regulation, but it's still a useful tool for doing that catchment scale accounting in London. And I think it would be very useful for council to have that information. Essential for them to have that information in order to do catchment accounting and look at the plan change. So it would be the council needs that information. Whether they gather it for the rest of the content or another method is a different discussion, but they do need that information.
But that's at the catchment scale rather than the individual farm scale?
Well, it needs at the catchment scale, but the catchment scale is made up of individual farms.
And then just finally, in your answer just then in terms of catchment modelling, you talked about using the best tool available. In terms of from a drafting gate perspective, I take it your view is then that the NRS is the best tool available?
In terms of drafting gate?
Yes.
In my version, in my evidence, I've used
you. No further questions.
That was Thompson. Thompson, thank you.
Good afternoon. My name's Marv. You'll be pleased to know that, like any councillor who's been doing this for a while, you get to 4 p.m. and put lots of lines through lots of questions. Try to pay attention to what's going on around you. So that's the starting point. So I'm going to forego some of the stuff that I was going to ask you, the fundamentals, but I may come back to it. I want to start with the notion of farming to the grass curve, which you will know is a very important part of my client Beacon Land and our co-party Federated Farms case. And I just want to check to ensure we understand that term in the same way. And farming to the grass curve, as I understand it, is, as it's at its simplest, adjusting stock numbers to reflect pasture supply. And so do you agree with that?
That's my understanding of the phrase.
And that means you minimise inputs, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
Nitrogen, fertilisers and those sorts of things.
Well, it's my understanding that you adjust your stock numbers rather than importing feed.
Yes, okay. And the alternative, of course, is fixed stock numbers, which means you have to bring in inputs to maintain those numbers despite what's going on around you. Would that be fair?
That's my understanding.
And so the very notion of farming to the grass curve brings with it a need for flexibility in response to, I'm going to say externalities, but I'm talking about things like rainfall and whatnot. Okay, great. So we get then to Dr. Crystal's evidence, and I understand you're in court for Dr. Crystal's evidence and expect you would have read it as well. And she talks about, in general terms, a large range of actions available to farmers to adopt, let's call it, good management practice when it comes to farming. Is that your understanding of what she...
Yes, she said a very good comprehensive review of the literature on management actions that influence consumer costs.
And those different actions will have different costs, won't they? And some of them are easy and quick to implement.
Yes.
And a good example of that might be Olsen P testing, low-hanging fruit type stuff. And ideally, would you agree with me that you would implement the most effective mitigations early, regardless of cost, in a perfect world?
Ideally, you would do the most effective ones, yes.
But of course, we're not in a perfect world, so you have to make sacrifices, right? And that's the function of the Section 32 analysis, isn't it?
Well, yes,
we're
talking about designing the plan or designing farm plan.
In terms of applying a Section 32 analysis to D1 and D2, and I use the word sacrifices, and I think that's possibly a little bit inaccurate, but you're making choices, aren't you, on various factors like cost and those sorts of things.
Yes, I just
need
to clarify, we're talking about the design of the plan or the direction that the plan is going to fund on.
Yeah, the direct, the latter.
Okay. I'm not sure it does give that kind of guidance. It talks about minimising losses and directing attention towards certain outcomes. And the way I read it, it's then leaving the decision about which actions and the order of those actions and the timing of those actions to farmer and their farm environment planner. So it's quite flexible. Farm environment planning framework is quite flexible in that regard.
Yes, and that's responding to, amongst other things, the evidence of the farming witnesses, the extensive evidence of the farming witnesses about the practicality of mitigations. And you might recall Mr. Berry's evidence. You've read that. And he gives extensive evidence about making paddocks unworkable if you put fences in odd places and so on. As well as the availability of fences, that's another constraint, isn't it, to say, fencing again?
Yes. So my understanding of how the skill D1, D1, D2 work is that it's asking the farmer to jump from things, direct their attention towards things, and then identify actions that are going to help minimise contaminant losses. The discretion comes in as to what's the right solution for this property to minimise losses, because each farming property is going to have different in terms of its landscape, its operation, and the combination of those factors. So it is necessarily a case-by-case analysis of which tools need to be applied on that farm. And the thing that holds them all together is that they're all working towards the same goal of minimising contaminant losses.
Right, okay. And can I just check, did you read the evidence of Mr. Burke for Beacon Lamb as well?
I'm not sure that I did read Mr. Burke's evidence.
Do you recall his evidence, just to double check, that on-farm inflation 22-23 was at about 16.3%? Do you recall that? And were you in court when Mr. Burke gave evidence?
No, I think I missed him, unfortunately.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
And you haven't looked for notes of evidence?
Not for that witness, no.
All right. I'd like you now just to perhaps help me with something to get my head around what you're proposing. So I'm thinking about, or I want to ask you about your proposal for timeframes for the implementation of farm plan actions, and you cited my witness, Dr. Crystal's evidence as a factor causing you to reconsider your previous approach. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. So, can I just get you to confirm whether you are seeking a time frame for completion of actions in farm plans, for D1 farm plans, or only for D2 farm plans? Mm-hmm.
Well, the policy requires moderate risk, farms in the moderate risk category, to reduce their diffuse discharges to as low as practical over an appropriate specified period. So if somebody's making an assessment in an appropriate specified period, then the wording around 8 years would be relevant to that consideration. So that it would apply to D1 and D2. But D1 farm plans don't have very much discretion in them about appropriate specified periods. A lot of the provisions in there are required immediately.
Okay.
Management changes to be implemented.
Okay, well, if we can just work through that then, because just to let you know where I'm going, on my reading, your amendment to policy 2, what is it, 2D Roman 2, would, based on my reading, only apply to D2 farm plans. So I suppose one way we can deal with this is for me just is to ask you, do you intend that 8 years to apply to D1 farm plans and D2 farm plans, or just a D2 farm plan?
I intend for it to apply whenever a farm environment planner is exercising discretion as to what is an appropriate specified period.
Right. So you haven't really moved from the position you had prior to Dr. Crystal's evidence, when you were suggesting an 8-year time frame for the implementation of those actions? Because as I understand, that was the position earlier.
Yes, it was. I think the difference is that I accept that the wording that I proposed earlier came across very rigid. A farm plan finishes in 8 years and you have to do everything in it. Whereas I understood the concern Dr. Crystal was raising was that a farm plan should be more of a living document that just keeps going. And I think that is a good thing, because as new management techniques come up, if they can be applied to farm, it's a good thing if they are. The purpose of Clean Change 1 is to achieve a specific improvement in water quality in the next 10 years. And Clean Change 1 relies on farm environment things to achieve that. So it's important that in order to achieve that effective actions on farms to reduce losses as low as reasonably practical do happen quite soon so that those 10-year goals can be achieved. So whenever there is a discretion about farm plan in relation to achieving the goals of Clean Change 1, that ought to be guided by some boundaries. Where that farm plan is doing extra pieces, going further than Clean Change 1, then a longer time period is totally appropriate if the farmer is going further than Clean Change 1 steps, which they may choose to do.
So I'm just trying to understand how that might work, because if I've understood you correctly, you've just said that if you need longer, you can have it for an action under a farm plan. Would that apply universally, or would that only apply from time to time? I'm struggling to land it a little bit. I'm sorry, the fault might be mine.
I'm sorry if I'm not explaining it clearly. Plan Change 1 relies on farm environment plans to reduce contaminant losses in order to achieve in-stream goals.
Yes.
And Policy 2 sets out the expectation that contaminant losses be reduced to as low as reasonably practical within an appropriate specified period. That has, in order to achieve the 10-year goal, so the actions need to be undertaken to get to as low as practical within that time frame to achieve the 10-year goal. Now, if a farmer wants to change their farm system, retire gullies in order to achieve biodiversity gains, they might all be part of the farm plan. Changes are not necessary to achieve the goals of Plan Change 1, but the farmer may wish to have a farm environment plan that defines goals, then the specified time periods in Plan Change 1 are irrelevant to those kinds of goals. It's reducing contaminant losses that needs to happen within the specified period.
Right. And so the phrase appropriate specified period, could you just have Policy 2 in front of you, please? The version attached to your evidence is fine. That was Appendix 1 to your evidence. Have a go, let's see if we can get out of here quicker.
So, farms that are categorised as low risk are permitted activities.
Yes.
And their appropriate specified periods only apply to farms that are moderate risk or high risk. So, the 8-year period doesn't apply to those farms that are low risk and categorised as permitted activities. I agree.
Right, and was that your intention? Okay, all right, excellent. Well, thank you. That's actually very helpful. I find myself answering questions, but thank you for talking us right through.
Sorry, I took you a long time to catch up.
No, 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 knows? Okay. Alright, so your position is that you are seeking that the 8-year appropriate specified period applies to D2 farm plans, not D1. Right, okay. So if we imagine for a moment, or if we go back a little bit and we were talking about Dr. Crystal's laundry analogy, always comes to my mind. And another one of my witnesses, Mrs. Foster, referred to farming as not being a biscuit factory. Do you remember that as well, sir?
Yes.
And you agree? Yes, it's all very poetic. I just want to put a couple of scenarios to you in the context of a D2 farm plan. So we'll put D1 aside. If we imagine for a moment there is a consented D2 farm plan in place, which requires actions to be completed within 8 years, and in say, you know, let's say it's year 6 or year 7, and a farmer says, well, it's year 6 and the plan was to do X, whatever it is. And she says, I got 50% through that and realised that it wasn't effective, or technology had changed or something similar, and therefore I'm better to do Y. Ian, you'd agree with me that that's consistent with the continuous improvement obligations?
And the requirement to review farm plans periodically.
And under your proposal, would that cause problems because now you can't complete something within 8 years?
In that scenario, farmer would be seeking to change the FFP, and they may also then need to change the condition of their consent. And so the council would then have to think about what an appropriate specified period would be in that scenario.
Would it be the case, though, that with the 8 years that you've put upon it, that would only be, we said, I think that's in year 6, that would only be 2 more years, wouldn't it? There wouldn't be an ability to push it out?
Yes, the ruling I've put in front of the board at the moment is that actions are completed within 8 years. What I've failed to do is specify when that 8 years begins. So it could begin when the consent is issued, or it could begin when the farm plan is written, or it could begin when the plan is operative, and I haven't specified that, and it would be helpful to set that out.
You'd expect from me that you would need flexibility to account for those sorts of circumstances within any time frame you set.
I think that would be sensible if what the farmer was proposing was going to be, if the extension of time was being sought because they had found a more effective or more targeted methodology, then that should be something that's taken into account.
Might it be simpler to forego a time frame and rely on the certified farm planner and the council officers to impose sensible time frames guided by the policies, which I think I'm pretty sure you would accept with your changes, implement the objectives and ultimately give effect to the superior planning documents?
I have concerns that the phrase within an appropriate specified period is too vague for there to be consistent interpretation of it.
And that's even with the balance of your changes in your marked up policy 2 that's been put to court today.
he, in his vehicle that he puts to the objective, which is to achieve real change within 10 years, there needs to be some wording that keeps it to that. So that we don't get a perverse scenario where a farm plan is written that says, I've identified the actions and I'm going to complete them in 15 years. That isn't going to get us to our objective if that happens consistently. And even if it's
so if we're looking at the second bullet of your Roman 2, which says, consider the appropriate length of time to spread the costs of actions and mitigations, could what you've just been indicated your concern is, could that be fixed by adding a reference to those 10-year interim targets within that bullet point?
Possibly, yes.
And would that solve my problem with the flexibility that we've been talking about, do you think?
It could do it. I would, I have to say word and see how that's framed, but
okay.
Yes, as long as what's needed in that policy is an outer bound for the time.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, just while you're on your changes to Policy 1, Policy 2 from today, I just have one question regarding Policy 1 and Schedule D1. And in Policy 1, you're proposing the deletion of Policy 1E in its entirety.
Yes, that's just me
catching
up with Mr.
Kiyoko. Yes, okay. Excuse me. Now, we've discussed the application of timeliness and timeframes to D1 and your changes, proposed changes to Policy 2 not applying to D1. So if I'm right about that, do you think that retention of the first part of Policy 1E to the effect of where farm environment plans are required, requiring the timely implementation of farm environment plans, full stop, would mean that there's policy recognition for the need to achieve those outcomes in D1 as well?
Yes, and I think in the council's version, timely implementation is in course A, but I don't have a firm view of whether it needs, which clause it should be in, but timely implementation is a good policy direction.
Yes, so we need that to capture D1, don't we? So that's important. Okay, thank you. I want to move to riparian planting and the costs of riparian planting and other factors. And you heard my questions of Dr. Daniel earlier today, I trust. Now, based on Dr. Daniel's evidence, which he was clear focused on woody riparian margins for wider stream ecosystem health. Are you proposing woody riparian vegetation for all waterways where stock is excluded or not? Okay, alright. And again, looking at your version of Policy 2, you in sub-policy H, and perhaps it's easy for me to read it, you say encouraging creation of riparian buffers where practicable, in addition to those required by the stock exclusion setbacks required on Schedule C. Do I understand from that your position is that there is requirements, or there should be requirements in Schedule C for riparian planting within those stock exclusion areas?
What I'm saying is that Schedule C, by having setbacks, does create a riparian buffer. It does not require it to be planted with woody vegetation, but the rank grass that will grow within that area does provide a buffer.
Right, okay. So one will follow the other in effect.
That's correct.
Okay, alright. Can I just ask you about, I like my chances here of being finished just after 5 p.m, a couple of minutes past.
I'm glad you like your chances. It's all about risk.
Yeah. And not promising too much. Schedule D1D4B, I'm just going to read that to you. It is a standard relating to soil and erosion, I think. Yes, but anyway, but it reads on land value C class 6E, and I think the parties have agreed generally to delete the reference to 6E, 7 or 8 with a slope greater than 20 degrees, no cattle older than 2 years or greater than 400 kilograms live weight are grazed from 1 June to 1 September. Okay. Now, do you have any experience with enforcement at all? Do you have experience going on site to assess whether a client complies with rules for the purpose of advising him, her, or it as to whether a resource consent is required?
No, not as a planner. I'm not a farm planner.
Okay.
I don't go on site and assess farms for farm environment purposes.
Okay.
And I haven't had an enforcement role with council in the past either.
All right. That's fine. You're a farmer though, right?
I own a farm.
Yeah.
I live on a farm.
Yes.
But my husband does a farm.
Well, I'm sure you do more than you live on.
I'm busy.
We won't ask you about preferences. But can I just ask you, do you have cattle beasts on your farm?
Yes.
Do you know how easy it is to eyeball cattle and tell whether it's 400 kilo live weight or not?
I know our stock agent can do that very well, actually,
right.
In paddock. Mostly, it's my understanding that people grade cattle by age class, really more than weight. You want to measure in other ways and bring them into the yard.
Okay. Well, I won't take that any further. Thank you. Right, last topic. If I understand your position correctly, we have in Schedule C a trigger for when we need to exclude stock from water bodies. And if I understand your recommendation correctly, you are recommending stock exclusion from the water bodies in Schedule C on slopes greater than 15 degrees and where there is more than 18 stock units per hectare in a single paddock. I think that's what your council submission said. Numbered page 25, I don't know what the electronic PDF number is.
Yes, that is my evidence. That is what the
decision's version. Okay, and that's Schedule C 1B, Roman 2. Is that right? Is that where that's going?
Yes.
And do you maintain your position, notwithstanding the evidence of my client, Beef and Lamb, that is an appropriate trigger for stock exclusion?
Actually, I do recall discussions that perhaps that threshold should be higher and be more like 24 stock units in the paddock.
Yes, I think that was the evidence of Mr. Allen.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. So we might just work through it then. Do you recall Dr. Crystal's evidence about stocking density versus stocking intensity?
Not well enough to understand the distinction.
That's fine. So, a stocking intensity is the average number of stock units a property carries over a year or at a particular point in time. Do you recall that? Or are you prepared to accept that from me? Very good. And stocking density, are you prepared to accept from me that it's the average number of stock units grazed in a particular paddock occurring a grazing event.
That makes sense.
Okay, right. And so the way the trigger for exclusion obligations work in Schedule C would be you work out the number of stocked units for each hectare of the paddock. So it was using your number of 18, in a 2-hectare paddock that would be up to 36 stock units before your obligations to exclude a trigger. Is that right?
Correct.
And so the proposal you support is a stocking density, right?
Yes.
Okay. And for convenience, we'll use your provisions. And your version of the provisions, which is page 170 of your evidence, there's a definition which has 7.5 stock units for one beef cow. Do you need to check that, or can you accept that comment? Okay. So at 18 stock units, that's just a little over 2 beef cows per hectare. Is that right?
That sounds right.
Okay. And you recall the joint witness statement for the farm systems experts, the majority of the experts calling 18 stock units incredibly low?
Yes.
And you accept the expertise of those experts and you have no evidence to suggest that 18 stock units is anything other than incredibly low?
In a paddock.
In a paddock per hectare?
Yes.
And would you accept that the example you gave of 24 is not much higher than the 18? Do some quick maths, it's not quite another big kill.
Just over
2. Right, and do you recall the evidence of Mr. Berry and others and talking about rotational grazing versus set stocking and the benefits of rotational grazing? And so rotational grazing you'd accept as an important part of a dry stock system.
Yes.
And so an implication of the stocking rate within a paddock that's too low, you would accept that would force farmers to set stock instead, wouldn't you?
No,
what
would I accept it would force them to set stock instead.
Okay.
No.
So they'd have to either de-stock or set stock. Would you accept that?
No, because the plan's not binary. It's not you either do this or you stop. It has options around seeking exceptions for resource consent and having other management frameworks.
I shouldn't rush, but I'm mindful of my promise to his honour. Would you accept that putting resource consent to one side, that if a farmer chose to set stock, that carries risk because it's not as flexible as rotational grazing? Would you accept that?
Well, my understanding is that they're completely different grazing techniques for different purposes. So I'm not sure about categorising risk in that context.
They're
completely different.
Okay.
Grazing techniques, my understanding.
I'll leave it there, thank you, Your Honour.
Have you completed your
cross examination? My cross examination, thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Let me just check for one of the case for Ms. Brothers. Do you have questions?
No, I don't.
You don't? All right. Can you just hold any questions for this witness, Ms. Ford?
We've got about
10 minutes,
sir.
Yes, all right. And then Mr. Ferguson.
Yes, I have a few questions.
Yes, all right. So, we'll adjourn now, and again, and I'm sorry, we'll be under cross-examination overnight, but we'll see you back here tomorrow morning. I'm just going to check about the time for that. So we'll start tomorrow morning at 9:30, everyone. Complete cross-examination and any questions the court may have for you. And then I think we'll be straight on to Horticulture New Zealand and Kauri Vegetable Growth.
Yes, thank you.
Very good. Any housekeeping matters or other, anything else anyone wants to raise?
Yes, Sue, I just thought I might give an update on the court's questions regarding fencing crops.
Oh, yes.
Yes. So just to let the court know, the experts are still talking, so
yes.
I understand in terms of the wetland mapping questions, Dr. Robinson and Dr. Bradshaw are meeting with Dr. Scarsbrook. He's been away, so there's been time lost in that. So they'll be discussing on Wednesday this week. And then Mr. Council is reaching out to Dr. Lemur because there's some questions relating to the input he's had. So that's how it's tracking at this time, soon.
Thank you for letting us know.
Thank you.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.